This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, joined today by Todd Zwillick. Merry Christmas Eve, Todd.
Merry Christmas to you, John, and to you, listeners, however you celebrate. Thank you for listening. This hour, we talk to a lawyer representing three Syrian refugee families detained in Texas. And on the biggest movie release day of the year, the Movie Date crew is here, Kristen Meinzer and Rafer Guzman.
And we'll welcome Sean Ramaswaram back for a special holiday Thursday 5.
But we begin this hour with a look at Cuba. It's been a year of big change in the relationship between the United States and Cuba. One thing that hasn't changed yet, though, is the so-called wet foot, dry foot policy. That allows Cubans who make it to the United States, the actual dry land of the United States, to get residency after just 1 year. For more on that policy and a look at the current flow of Cubans to the U.S., we turn to Mark Rosenblum. He's deputy director of the U.S. Immigration Policy Program at the Migration Policy Institute.
Cuba is definitely completely unique of all countries in the world, primarily with that wet foot, dry foot policy that you mentioned, which says, essentially, as it's been implemented, which says that any Cuban who reaches U.S. soil is paroled into the country and becomes eligible to apply for a green card a year after arrival. It's the only country that gets treated like that. And it's also the only country that has a guaranteed minimum number of permanent residents that are admitted each year. In addition to immediate family members, the U.S. promises Cuba that at least 20,000 Cubans can come legally to the U.S. each year.
Now, let's be clear. The peculiarities that we're talking about, all of them owe to the legacy of making Castro look bad, right? That's why it's different than any other country. If you can get out of Cuba, get your feet to Florida, you're in.
Right. It's definitely a legacy of the Cold War. It dates back to the 1966 Cuban Adjustment Act, which passed, you know, about 7 years after the Cuban Revolution. And I think that's right. It was in large part to make Castro look bad. And also at the time, based on the idea that people fleeing Cuba were, by definition, political refugees who were fleeing a repressive communist regime.
All right. And now that those relations are warming, now that the Cold War is over and we're no longer necessarily referring to Cuba as a repressive regime, I mean, we've all seen the news. We're warming up relations. We're normalizing things. This policy is going to have to change, right?
It certainly seems anachronistic and hard to defend. I mean, it's based on the presumption that Cuba is uniquely repressive, that people fleeing Cuba are uniquely eligible for refugee status. And when you look around the world, I mean, certainly there are still real problems in Cuba, and there are political prisoners. But when you look around the world, or even when you look around the hemisphere, there are plenty of other countries where people are fleeing, you know, arguably more difficult conditions and have a greater claim to being refugees. And then with relations warming, it's also true that regular travel, legal travel, is increasing. And it's difficult to have people regularly visiting the U.S. from Cuba as long as we have that Cuban Adjustment Act in place, because it's easy for them essentially to defect. And once they're here, you know, to apply to become permanent residents and eventually U.S. citizens.
Right. I mean, if you're going to keep the same policy and it becomes easier to travel and you don't have to make a raft as long as you have the money to get across the straits there to Key West or to Miami, then it's completely self-defeating, because if any Cuban that can scrape the money together can fly to the U.S., which they'll be able to do before long, you've got a problem.
You know, the other thing that we're already seeing is that, you know, since relations have been normalized, Cubans recognize that this program, you know, may be on its way to being phased out. And so we've seen a huge increase in the last year in Cubans traveling illegally to the U.S., mostly by flying to Ecuador and then traveling by land through Central America and through Mexico and reaching the U.S. Those numbers have increased like fourfold in the last 5 years, and mostly just in the last year, as Cubans seek to take advantage of the Cuban Adjustment Act while it still exists.
And while it still exists, we've seen the U.S. ambassador or the U.S. representative say in the pages of the New York Times and maybe elsewhere that policy's not changing anytime soon, the Cuban Adjustment Act policy. I mean, he sort of has to say that, right?
Right. He certainly can't say we're revisiting that and it may phase out, because then, you know, that's really an invitation to Cubans to get in while the getting's good. So I think, you know, we'll continue to see officials, you know, in both countries say that this arrangement is not being negotiated until the day that it goes away.
Mark Rosenblum, let's parse the politics here for 1 second, because there's just such a remarkable difference when you look at, say, the reaction that many Americans have had towards Syrian refugees and the prospect of even 10,000 refugees from a place like Syria coming to the United States. At the same time, we have a policy, as we've discussed, that lets any Cuban who can reach U.S. shores have a green card and stay. But at the same time, until, I don't know, 6 months ago, Cuba was on the official state sponsor list of terrorism, but nobody's worried about those Cubans being terrorists. Talk about the contrast.
I think, as you said, it's very much a function of politics and of the strong Cuban constituencies in South Florida and elsewhere that elect members of Congress who represent their immigration interests and represent a strong voting bloc really solidly around these immigration issues. So it's hard to look at the different standards for Cubans versus Syrians or for Cubans versus Central Americans and justify them sort of based on objective reality. It's very much a function of the politics.
Relations are changing between the United States and Cuba, and there are going to be lots of hot flashpoints along the way, the embargo and also the intricacies of immigration policy between the United States and Cuba. Mark Rosenblum is Deputy Director of U.S. Immigration Policy at the Migration Policy Institute. Mark Rosenblum, thank you.
Thank you.
President Obama inaugurated the holiday season with the suggestion next year in Havana. After starting the process of normalizing relations with Cuba all this year, he wants to complete the job and visit Cuba before he leaves office. If he makes it, he'll be visiting a much more Catholic country, where the church long scorned by the Communist Party is coming out into the sunlight. What's it like to be living as a Catholic in Cuba right now? For that, we turn to a lifelong Catholic who was born and raised in Havana following the revolution.
Not everything is fine, but people are suspecting that a little bit these steps could bring better opportunities for the Cuban people.
How has the Catholic Church been at the center of these changes?
Involved, because both presidents, you know, they expressed their gratitude to the Holy Father, Pope Francis, who got involved in this process that both government previously had started in a secret way. But I think it shows the goodwill of the church to bring together two countries that for many years were separated by confrontations and hate and Cold War, etc. And even before the Pope Francis got involved in this process, the Bishops' Conference, both in the U.S. and also in Cuba, many times made this kind of request to both governments in order to bring peace to both people, especially the Cuban people, small people, and with families separated for many years, because many of the Cuban families live in the U.S., or even in other countries, and part of the family remaining here, separated by confrontations, by policy, by ideology, by all these situations. And we expected for many years this moment that was a great moment for us last year.
How has that changed the identity of the church in Cuba? Are people coming back to the Catholic Church in their cultural lives?
Let's say this, for example. Catholic Church in Cuba and Catholic practitioners in Cuba, we are a minority in this country. On the other hand, after the visit of three popes, people are rediscovering, if I can say that, the origin of their faith and are removing the dust that for many years was covering that faith, and is recognizing every day the possibilities of the church and the work of the church in the society.
Orlando, you lived through those years of dust and the church really hiding and not being a part of mainstream culture. What was that like?
Well, it was because of the atheist program were prepared from the government, from the instance of the government. Cuba was part of the Soviet line, Soviet group during the Cold War, and atheism was part of the system, and the believers and faith was seen like something from the past that should be left behind. But it failed, because you cannot remove the faith of the people just because of a decree or something like that. There were tough years indeed. We knew what it was to suffer some kind of pressure, be under pressure, not in the same way as in some countries in Eastern Europe, because the church, no matter the pressure, was never prohibited in Cuba. And yes, it's true, some priests were expelled. Some others who were studying abroad never received the permission to get into the country again. And the number of priests fell down in a huge way. But anyway, those who decided, many Catholics left the country also, this migration that hasn't stopped yet, especially to the U.S., but many Catholics decided to stay here. I was a child in the 60s, and I remember every Sunday when I went to Mass, a new stained glass was broken by a stone thrown from a Bronx, etc. But anyway, we continued attending Mass, etc. I grew up as Catholic, as many others, my friend. We knew from the moment that we are a small group. But anyway, we live in this society. In the end, I think we gained the respect of those who were among us.
Orlando, what's your greatest hope looking forward?
Well, it's not easy to talk about happiness, but my greatest hope is see the Cuban people recovering their own life and having a normal and better life. This is my greatest hope. I think we are in the process. There is a long way to go yet. And many things, not only the relationship between Cuba and the U.S. Could bring a better opportunity, but more steps must be taken within the country. Huge steps must be taken within the country, giving more opportunity to the Cuban people, to the Cuban population, to express and bring about with the armed capabilities and possibilities of in the good of this country.
Orlando, it's really great to speak with you, and have a great holiday.
The same for you, sir.
Orlando Marquez Hidalgo, who's director of the Catholic monthly magazine Palabra Nueva of the Archdiocese of Havana.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.